This episode, we talk Michigan defeating Alabama, Washington defeated Texas, somebody with a B-roll flub on Bourbon Street. Why'd the damn game start so late?
Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
Yeah, I don't care about back. I mean, no offense to anyone back then, you know, but I don't care. In modern college football, this might have been their greatest victory.
Russ Dellinger.
It was a work of art. And to think that they almost lost the game, right? They came one pass away from losing the game is pretty wild.
And SI's Pat Forty.
The fans get used and abused, but they put up with it. And so it's just going to keep happening this way. But it is a complete miscarriage, really, to have games, big games, games people care about immensely, ending at 1 in the morning.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
Hi, welcome to the pod. And we have had some bad semifinal games through the years. In the 10-year stretch of the 4-team playoff, there have been some bad ones. Today, it went out with a bang. Doesn't get a whole lot better than this. Michigan 27, Alabama 20, overtime. Washington 37, Texas 31, with what did Texas have? 5 or 6 passes into the end zone at the end of the game?
Three, I think, actually.
Three? They had one earlier.
Yeah,
At least four.
I mean, yeah.
Unbelievable. The cardiologists of Seattle were happy with this game. Washington was almost going to blow it in unbelievable fashion. And Texas was going to come back. Michigan dominated the first half. Looked like they were going to blow it. Special teams, missed field goals, muffed punts. You name it. Anyway, just absolute battles from all four teams. We tip our hat to all of them because they gave us an incredible night of college football. It is 3:54 a.m. and we're talking ball.
Mm. Thank you, Rose Bowl.
In the sunset.
Yeah.
We're going to get to that because I'm sorry for the people that are listening to this that didn't get to watch Texas Washington because no one can tell the freaking Rose Bowl that they have to start their semifinal at 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. The games are too good to get into it now, but we will get into it. I have thoughts, Pat. I have thoughts, as you like to say.
We thought you would. Thought you would.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Are we here for the customers or some BS? No. BS. Just arrogance. Anyway, let's go to the game because it was the sunset was spectacular. Game was even better. I'll just leave the floor open. I'll start with you, Pat. Thoughts?
First game, Michigan, Alabama?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really an impressive, gritty kind of regrouping when on the brink for Michigan. You know, they were down 20-13. Nothing was going their way. You know, it just looked like Alabama was slowly squeezing them out, as Alabama has been known to do. And then they rally, you know, and they put together the tying drive and get it into overtime. And then obviously Blake Corum wins it in OT. But just very impressed. As you said, like Michigan had to be sick at halftime that they were only winning by 3. They should have been winning by 10, 14, whatever. And, you know, you let Alabama hang around. It's got to be the worst feeling in the world. Nick Saban's on the other sideline, and they're still in the game. And but they regrouped. They rallied. J.J. McCarthy made some big plays. His receivers stopped dropping passes, and they got it done, you know. So I really thought that was going to end badly for Michigan for a good part of the second half, and instead they found a way to win.
Yeah, I just look at it from kind of the 30,000-foot view. What this the win means for Michigan in the Big Ten, honestly, given the track record with the SEC, Michigan's track record with the SEC, Michigan Big Ten's track record with the SEC, Michigan's track record with bowl games. I saw a stat that Jim Harbaugh and Bo Schembechler were like, Bo Schembechler was like, you know, 2-8 maybe in Rose Bowls. Does that sound right?
Yep. Yeah.
And Harbaugh is 1-6 in bowl games. It's just huge to do it and to do it against Alabama, right? Do it against the SEC champion, do it against Nick Saban. My goodness. Just huge for that program and huge for that league. And you knock out the big bad SEC. But like, as far as the game on the field, and I got to watch about, you know, two quarters of it, just in and out of travel and in making the rounds of our game in New Orleans. But I saw the Alabama come back, you know, and take that 2013 lead, and I just figured, well, that's it, right? Like Nick Saban and Alabama don't blow that very often late, but it shows a lot about Michigan and JJ McCarthy. You know, JJ McCarthy outplayed Jalen Milroe for sure, right? When you look at Alabama and its season, it really comes down to like kind of consistent quarterback play, right? And that's it felt like what kind of bit them here, right? When you look at some of the numbers and stuff, and then they couldn't block for him either, right? I think he was sacked 5 or 6 times, Jalen Milroe. So yeah, I mean, Michigan's like front. Michigan's lines are just incredible. The O-line, the D-line, I mean, they're just huge. And this championship matchup, which I'm sure, you know, we'll get to later, but I'm excited about the matchup of these lines. And it's another big matchup for the Joe Moore award-winning offensive line in Washington against another really good defensive front.
I was talking to someone at Alabama a few days ago, and he said, "What'd you think?" I said, "Well, you have more talent, but I'm telling you, Michigan, they get first downs like 10 yards and 1 inch. They just find ways. They're just they have to be infuriating to play against. You're like, we got them. They scored a TD with 4:42 left in the second quarter to take a 13-7 lead. And Alabama made a huge, comes down, got a field goal, 13-10. From that point on, it was punt, 3 and out, or six plays, 21 yards punt, 3 plays, 2 yards punt, 3 plays, 1 yard punt. Then they get a turnover. They go 5 plays, 20 yards. They miss a field goal.
Yeah.
They were going nowhere.
Right.
They were going nowhere. And the play that will be etched in Michigan lore was the 4th and 2, 3:19 left in the game. They're on their own 33-yard line. It's 4th and 2. They have 3 timeouts, and kicking the ball is the standard operating procedure. Michigan called an extremely aggressive game again. Sharon Moore calls aggressive football games, sometimes too much today, but he goes for it. They went for it. Beautiful play call to Blake Corum, gets 27 yards. And all of a sudden, it was like the whole game swung. They hadn't done anything in over a half a football. And I don't know. It looked like everything changed. Michigan thought they could win. Alabama, maybe not. And they get down there. They tie it. And then they get to overtime. They score pretty easily. And then they hold. We get to the final play if you want. That always seems to get a lot of attention, even though there's a million other plays in front of it. But to Ross's point, I think it is a historic victory for Michigan. They don't win this game.
Right.
To say this is the greatest victory in Michigan football history, it's not out of the debate. I don't know what happened in the 40s and stuff, but like some
Benny Oosterbaugh might disagree with you.
Yeah, I don't care about back. I mean, no offense to anyone back then, you know, but I don't care. In modern college football, this might have been their greatest victory. They certainly have a few over Ohio State, but other than that, they get the Washington State one in 97 in the Rose Bowl to win a share of the title. But to go and finally beat the SEC, you know, when they beat Ohio State, it was like they won 3 games in 1 because they could kind of, at least to a degree, put the Connor Stallions thing aside. To a degree, but if they had lost that game, Ohio State would have been able to go, "Oh, we never lost to you."
Yeah.
They won that game. So what do you want now? We didn't have Harbaugh. We didn't have Connor. So we didn't have anything. this feels a little like they won the last two playoff games too. Like, okay, we're not just this phony from the Midwest that shows up. We're serious. We can win a national title. So I thought that was there was just a lot to this game for Michigan.
I think I said it on the pod the first time I saw Michigan in person. It was a Penn State game. I think I came on here and said, boy, like, this is they like pound you to death, block you to death, tackle you to death, right? It's like this was such that kind of game, that kind of score. And they did it again. And I remember saying on the pod, like, that this team I think at the time I said Georgia, right? These two teams are going to meet in their head and shoulders above everybody else. And obviously Georgia dropped the game against Alabama, but Michigan just continues to win, like, kind of the old school way. It's just not super fireworks and all this stuff. I mean, they don't throw for like 500 yards. They're not a Washington, right? I mean, it's an older kind of brand of football that's honestly refreshing in a way, right? It was just evident to me seeing them in person. I remember, just recall that Penn State game, seeing them in person, like, wow, like, you know, this is the team.
Yeah. And I mean, they used their formula to win, but I mean, I thought they'd blown it, frankly. Like, when they got the turnover, when Milroe fumbled and they got the ball around midfield and did nothing with it and missed the field goal, I was like, they're done. They missed their window of opportunity, but they weren't done. They, you know, found a way. And as Dan said, the big fourth and two, the decision to go and then to execute it the way they did. And they just made some very, very big plays at the end. And then, yeah, defensively, they kicked Alabama's offensive line's ass, which really isn't that surprising, because Alabama's offensive line hadn't been very good this year by Alabama standards. And Milroe holds the ball, and so he is sackable and has been sacked a lot. But Michigan, I thought, did a great job of dialing up pressures and finding ways to come at Milroe and either confuse him or to get him to the ground, both of which they did many times.
Six sacks. I think the line play, if you were looking at it and saying who's going to get six sacks, I would have thought it was Alabama. Instead, they had one. So Michigan was winning both sides. I think Dallas Turner only had three tackles. They kind of took him out of the game to a degree. The final play, the offensive line just blew up that right side of the line right into Milroe. You know, Alabama was not sharp.
No.
Obviously, that snap was low. There were snapping problems all over.
Yep.
One thing I think that happens in these games is no one's played for a month.
Yep.
And there's a lot of little stuff. I don't know if that'll go away some.
God, the Alabama snapping. I saw the center decline to speak to reporters after the game, and there was a great quote from one of the Michigan defensive players about it was like mid-game, I guess, and he was trying to have a conversation with the Alabama center about how crappy the snaps were, and he was like asking him, "What's going on, dude?" Like, and I think the Michigan defensive player was like, I wasn't trying to hate on him. I wasn't talking trash. I was like, yo, what's the problem? Like, you're sucking. Right. What's going on? And he's like, he didn't want to say anything to me. He didn't want to engage.
Yeah, I don't blame him. That would not be a conversation I would want to have at that point either.
Yeah, and that goes back to the last play. Right.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
snapping. Yes. There was an RPO. It's been broken down a lot. Yeah. The snap is low. And so Milroe can't read the RPO quick enough, which apparently there was the pass option was the swing route and the run option was what he took, which was his was basically a draw. And the swing route appeared to be open. Certainly there was leverage there in Alabama's favor, but he didn't have time because the snap was so bad.
Yeah. And it was an interesting quote from Saban about that, where, you know, there were back-to-back timeouts before that play. And he said we had three different plays called. And he said the first one, we had the right look, but Michigan called a timeout and changed out of the look and took it away. And so then Alabama called the timeout and changed it up again. And then bad snap and kablooey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now he had to run. Go ahead.
Good, Dan. No, I wanted to clarify. This is from Mike Rodak of 24/7. It was a Michigan defensive tackle, Chris Jenkins, on McLaughlin's snaps. I was like, what happened, bro? I was genuinely, like, confused. I wasn't even trying to talk trash. I was just like, what's going on? He ain't say nothing. Good stuff. Great stuff. Yeah, but, yeah, McLaughlin did not speak to reporters afterward. And, God, it was just pretty horrific. And Nick Saban, you know, I mean, the little things, right? The little details, that's how – outside from collecting talent, that's how Nick Saban's teams have won, is doing all the little things right and not making mistakes. And boy, that was a big little thing that
pre-snap
they screwed
penalties.
Up
on. Right.
There was a lot of non-Alabama stuff, but that final play, which of course is just the final play. I mean, they had plenty of chances to score, but yeah, the snap was off. Michigan's Josiah Stewart, one of their famed Massachusetts three stars, right? Absolutely blew up the Alabama line. That didn't help. I don't know if that pass option was going to work. People were like, oh, if he'd done that. Mikey Sanistro was there, another Massachusetts three star.
Big assumption. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was there to like bat it down, or you were going to have to loft it. I mean, it was a little bit like, it's not like there was a dude wide open in the end zone. Like a lot was going to have to happen. No. Michigan just plays really, really well. And they gagged this thing away too. Morgan with the flub of the punt. They got lucky the first pass of the game by McCarthy.
Yeah.
He's picked, but he's just out of bounds before he hadn't reestablished. Like they got lucky there. They had snap problems. They had everything. So it was a sloppy game for these two. But in the end, it was about who was going to make a play in overtime.
How about the two semifinal teams that muffed punts won the game?
Yeah. Yes, they did.
All three phases. Mm-hmm. Now, good for that game, or we got more? Any more thoughts on that game? Mm-hmm. Harbaugh declared J.J. McCarthy the greatest quarterback in the history of Michigan and college football.
Really not sure. Tom Brady was there with his $2 million watch.
Get someone to love you as much as Jim Harbaugh loves J.J. McCarthy.
Seriously. It is a flowing man crush of constant,
it's a little weird.
Like, adulation. Yeah. I will say this, he was not the best quarterback playing football today, so I'm not going with that.
Far
Michael
from it. Probably
Penix.
A good segue into the game Pat and I were at. Yeah, yeah. Just unbelievable. The guy, when Washington's Penix. Humming... Yeah, I mean, when Washington's humming with the deep kind of passes, I've said it on the pod before, and I tweeted it out, and the LSU fans come out of the bayou at me and got me pretty good. But, I mean, it really does remind me of the Burrow in 2019 when they're humming. I mean, they just didn't hum as consistently as that 2019 LSU team. But when they're on, it's incredible. I think he had maybe seven or eight completions today or tonight that were for 29 yards or more, I think, or something like that. I mean, it was unbelievable. At one point, he was averaging, like, he was 15 passes in, and he was averaging like 25 yards a completion. And he was just doing it all too. It was like he was doing the crossing route, the little swing pass where he does a sidearm pass. Then he lays it up there with the deep heaves, and receivers are making great catches. It was a work of art. And to think that they almost lost the game, right? They came one pass away from losing the game is pretty wild. You could probably go back to the 9 consecutive passes in the fourth quarter that Washington called, but as Ryan Grubb told me after the game, Michael freaking Penix, that's why we called those passes. So
that would have been the greatest theft of a game in playoff history if Texas had won. They never led, and yet they had a chance to win at the very end, like on the last play, 3 or 4, whatever the number of passes into the end zone. I was just, a crazy confluence of events between Washington not necessarily managing the clock ideally, and then the weird, you know, injury. Clock stoppage because of the injury.
Oh.
You know, Dylan Johnson, Kalen DeBoer said, yeah, we're going to run it down to 15, 20 seconds left, you know, but the clock stopped because Dylan Johnson gets hurt, and that will be an injury to watch for next week, by the way, too, because he's very important to that offense. But, you know, one thing after another, and then they interfere with the fair catch on the punt, give them 15 free yards, give up a 40-yard pass, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God. Washington might lose a game that they have completely controlled. It was crazy.
It was like that final drive. It was like, and I felt so bad for Dylan Johnson. Like, imagine you're going to lose the game because you got hurt and couldn't get off the field.
Right.
Like,
right.
What kind of a weird rule that is.
Yeah, it is.
I'd have to research the rule more to see whether it should be changed, but what a weird, weird rule. A guy gets hurt and almost costs him the shot in the national championship. But Texas ran 9 plays in 45 seconds. Like, it was like every time they, I don't know, Ewers drop back, throw a ball, 3 seconds off. I was like, what is going on?
Right. The clock wouldn't move.
The clock would not.
They put a second back. Yeah.
They put a second back, which is, I think, accurate. It was just an unbelievable deal, but Washington was so much better of a team. They had a real chance to put them away. They didn't quite do it.
Right.
You know, when they had a chance to get them down 13 and they couldn't pull it off. They did. They were kept going for it on fourths across the whole game, but Washington was the better team. And the right team won. That defensive play on the last play by Elijah Jackson was like, hang it in the Hall of Fame, like how to pass breakup.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was a Dikembe Mutombo swat at that ball to knock it out of there.
Remember that NFL?
I hate it. You know,
remember that game? Richard Sherman batted one in the corner away. Like it was just that perfect. That's kind of what that was. Like this is how you play defensive back.
Yeah,
I had no idea. You know,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the Superdome press box is so high up that, you know, it's hard to see things. But I was on the sideline during that, and I was on the opposite sideline, and I didn't know how close it was until after the game. I saw a replay, and I was like, wow, like it got incredibly close. And the Texas receiver has his feet in, so he catches it like it's game. And had no idea how close it was until after I followed my story and I saw the video right before leaving the press box. That was wild.
Yeah. Washington would never be, if you're a Washington fan, you would never be able to get over it if you would have lost that game because you played so well. Your team played fantastically, took the game by the throat right away, throw the long bomb to Jalen Polk, you know, get ahead, stay ahead. And then third quarter, domination, total domination. But, yeah, to Dan's point, a couple times you don't get in the end zone, you kick field goals instead, and you just let Texas hang around a little bit, and then all of a sudden three crazy things happen in a row, and boom, they're on the 13-yard line. You're like, I would have just been absolutely nauseated if I were a Washington fan watching that last sequence. Well, I did, as a matter of fact, I will say I looked down, like Dylan Johnson went into the injury tent and he came out and he was watching, you know, the defense out there and he was kind of like pacing around and I don't even want to think about how he must have felt watching.
There was broadcast of him leaving in a cart and cheering, like screaming in excitement. It was a classic pain of victory.
Yeah.
Like he's overjoyed, but he's got his, you know, so it's going to be a big injury. Kalen DeBoer after the game, just ice water.
He's unbelievable.
I mean, like, none of these guys really panic. Like, it's like Saban's out there getting all emotional, but he's like, it's more than this. And Harbaugh's so gets up there. I just want to wish everyone a happy new year.
Weirdo. Weirdo.
Yeah. Okay. Harbaugh's on his own planet. You know.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Hey, Michigan coach, just wish me a happy New Year. Feel good about that. You know, the poor whoever's trying to interview him. But Kalen DeBoer's just like, yeah, you know, we're just. I mean, this guy, NAIA, tough man. You learn to coach at NAIA, nothing rattles you.
Right.
You're sitting there going, I hope the bus has got gas in it for the ride home. You don't got time to worry about anything. He was just like, yeah, we played pretty good, you know, whatever. It's nothing. No emotion.
None. He was so matter of fact. And after the game ended, he's just like hanging out on the field for a half an hour, just talking to people. You know,
just,
I mean, just
stoic. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like the classic upper Midwest guy that can't be bothered with getting too high or too low with his emotion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And people were coming up to him like on the field after the game, like, hey, great win. Right? And he's like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, right. I mean, just,
what's going on here?
By the way,
Dylan Johnson. Yeah. No, it's going to give the Dylan Johnson update. We to go back really quickly.
Oh.
So I saw him in the locker room, and he, you know, I think Kalen DeBoer said this, but he, you know, reaggravated kind of like a foot ankle, right foot ankle injury. And you could see in the locker room, it was taped up. He walked off with a boot on his right foot, no crutches or anything, you know. So yeah, it's something to watch going forward
That's
sure.
That's good. We hope he can play.
Yeah.
Hope he can play.
But from our standpoint, I was a little bit perplexed and frustrated with Kalen DeBoer. Like, I wanted something. I wanted him to emote a little more. Give us something to write here, man. Just didn't happen.
Fascinating coaching matchup. DeBoer, obviously, you know, Sioux Falls, builds his way from Sioux Falls up. He's four seasons ago, he's the Indiana offensive coordinator.
Yeah.
2 years at Fresno, 2 years at Washington, just out of nowhere. But he's got this learn to coach at NAIA, at Sioux Falls, and won three titles. And you get Harbaugh, who's, you know, at this point, like the first family of football. I mean, his brother's got the best team in the NFL, and he might have the best team in college football.
Right.
It's crazy. Literally a, you know, lifer. But he, too, built himself up. He started at San Diego. So he's not, as he likes to say, you know, some people, what's his line? He gets third base, but they're not. Third or something, you know, whatever. He couldn't even pull off that third base line right. But
no,
that
he
almost
couldn't.
Made it,
he
that
couldn't.
Almost made it more good. But yeah, these two, like, it's interesting, but I don't think America knows who Kalen DeBoer is, and pretty much everybody knows who the Harbaughs are. If you know anything about, and you know, NFL quarterback for all these years, right? Saved by the Bell, he appeared. Judge Judy fan, been Judge Judy's total whack job, all the different stuff. Kalen DeBoer's just quiet. His win. I don't know that a lot of America really. I mean, they had a lot of big games this year, but I think this was the one that proved to the country that not only is this team for real, but this program is for real, and this coach
absolutely
is for real.
Yeah, and that, you know, if you want to go look at the recruiting rankings, they shouldn't be where they are, but they have put together a program and a team, and it's the third time in the last four games they've been an underdog, won them all, undefeated. They have won 10 straight games, all decided by 10 points or less. They've won 5 straight, decided by one score. So, you know, as crazy as the situation was that they ended up in at the end, they're used to being in these kind of tough, tough games, and they just believe they're going to win. They really do.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The two teams that lost were the two teams with, as far as recruiting rankings go, certainly with more talent, right? Like Texas and Alabama definitely had the talent edge when it comes to these recruiting rankings and star rankings and all that stuff. I think I saw somewhere, I don't remember, that Washington's was around the mid to high 20s as far as their like current roster, like recruiting ranking. And I think Michigan's were in the mid-teens.
I'll give it to you. It's the 24/7 sports does a team talent composite of all of the players that are on the team, and Alabama was number one, and it was the highest they'd ever recorded. I think Ari Wasserman of The Athletic says their average player is the 75th best recruit in the country, was the number, like a 75 recruit. Mm-hmm. That's astounding amount of talent. Texas was sixth. It went Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, Texas A&M, Clemson. I mean, that's amazing. You think about one guy got fired. Clemson had to fight with their Tyler from Spartanburg. Ohio State's in disarray. Like, oof. Yeah. Michigan was 14th. It went Texas, then LSU, USC, Oklahoma, Oregon, Notre Dame, Miami, Penn State, then Michigan. And yeah, Washington was 26th.
Mm.
0 5 stars.
Yeah.
Michigan has 2. Alabama had 18 5 stars on the roster yesterday.
Good glory.
Forever, you couldn't beat those top few teams, right? There's only a few teams could win the national title. Clearly, this year, you can. Now, I'm not going to say Michigan isn't pretty strong. This is their third year in a row, but they don't recruit at that level. Like, what is it just going to be a new era? Are we just in a new era that you can do it?
A couple thoughts there. One, we're still in the pandemic extra year era. And Washington has 9 sixth-year seniors on their team. They are a veteran, veteran, veteran team. And, you know, when Kalen DeBoer got there, he's done phenomenal work, but he did not inherit an untalented team. So they've got good players, and they're old. And so I think that's part of what their sauce is. Now, Michigan, the funny thing is, like, the NFL's going to want plenty of Michigan's guys. They might not have all been 5 stars coming out of high school, but they're going to get drafted. They're going to have a bunch of guys get drafted.
Yeah, each team kind of did it in a different way. Pat talks about the veteranness of Washington. Of course, I look at the quarterback position. When you can land somebody like that, where at any point in the game, you're 2 plays away from 14 points, you know, with Penix in the receiver. So you're just, they score so quickly. So that's like a game changer to me. Michigan just feels like one of those programs that, the whole developmental thing in just being so solid up front. And they win up front, you know. We don't usually see, 2 teams that are more talented, a lot more talented, both you know, lose those games. So that was interesting to watch.
Yeah, one thing I did want to point out real quick on the Washington Texas game, there was considerable amount of pregame discussion about Washington's offensive line, which won the Joe Moore Award, against Texas's defensive line, which is extremely good. And you could kind of tell, talking to both sides, that they thought they were the better unit. And Texas was like, yeah, let's just get on the field and we're going to see. And guess what we saw? 0 sacks of Michael Penix, only 3 tackles for loss for Texas. And part of that, Penix is really good at just moving around the pocket. He avoids sacks and he gets rid of the ball quickly. But that also was a credit to the offensive line for holding up really well against the Texas pass rush.
Michigan is old. They're finished, managed. You know, I look at the kid that they got as their kind of rotation defensive back late last transfer portal, Josh Wallace from UMass of all places.
Hmm.
And he played, he had a couple solo tackles tonight. He's on the field. And obviously he's good enough. He was a lot better than, you know, UMass, but who knows what his star ranking was, probably a 2 or something. I don't know.
Right.
But he also played like 39 games at UMass. Like, you just, at some point you just have like experience, and then you play 13 more this year and you're just playing a lot of games and you're older. And I agree. I think these COVID things are playing a role in it. But get old, stay old is a huge thing in this sport, because literally until yesterday or today or whatever it was, you couldn't do this. This just didn't happen.
Right.
It was Alabama, Texas. It's Clemson against Alabama. Like, that second tier had no chance. And in this case, they certainly did. And these weren't fluke victories. Like you said, they won the line of scrimmage. Washington won the line of scrimmage against Texas, and Michigan won the line of scrimmage against Alabama. I mean, that's a little less of a shock, but definitely a different type of season than we have seen coming. And there'll be a new national champion that we haven't had.
Yeah. And no team from the South is going to play in the championship game for the first time since 2014, when it was Ohio State against Oregon.
Yeah, the first one, right? And eight straight where at least one SEC team was in the final.
Yep.
Four straight SEC championships. Just means more. Ross, defend your people. What is going on?
You know that they were getting poised and ready to claim the Longhorns if they would have beat the Huskies. But alas, they cannot. And now, yeah, you have Big Ten, Pac-12, or you might say Big Ten, Big Ten. So now I'm sure if the Huskies win, you might have the other league claim a championship. This year the SEC was down. I think we all knew. We've talked about it on the pod quite a bit. You saw it was the worst non-conference, I think, in 6-7 years in the league. Worst non-conference, Power Five slate, a record. And I think they finished at 5-4, maybe SEC in bowl games, I want to say. It's kind of shocking to, even though we kind of knew that it might be coming, especially if Alabama beat Georgia, it was always more of a possibility that this might happen. And here we are.
Yeah. I was posing this question in the press box as we were watching Alabama, Michigan. Who was more sick today, Kirby Smart or Hugh Freeze? And Hugh's at least off the hook because Alabama's not going to win the national title. Like they giving up the 4th-and-31 did not lead their arch rival to winning a national championship. It did get him in the playoffs. So probably Kirby is the more sick because they've got a clear Alabama problem and they're a really good team. I mean, they did win their bowl game 63-3.
That was that bowl game,
the depleted Knowles.
Let's talk about that. Then we'll get to our prediction of the game.
Yeah.
Early prediction. So that was the game that everyone pointed to as like, this is just busted up. I mean, everybody from FSU sat out.
Yeah.
When Rodemaker, the second string quarterback who is now going to be the starter, just bailed. Yeah. I think he was sitting in like bowl practices going, I'm going to get murdered. I don't know. I don't want to say that why he quit, because I don't know why he hit the transfer portal. But that game got a lot of attention as a total, we need to fix this. And I you guys can have your opinion on this. I'd be interested to hear what you have to say. The default position in college athletics is we need a rule that will fix. That's how they approach
every.
Come up with a rule and it'll fix things. I don't know how you fix this. I don't know that there's anything to fix. That game was a joke. There was a couple others. But to have like coaches and people go, a lot of media, the bowl games don't mean as much. Well, you know why? In 1985, there were 18 bowl games.
Right.
In the mid-90s, there were 25. They're now 43 or something. 42. Of course, they don't mean. Those games didn't exist. Was every game an epic game back in the day? No. I don't think there's a problem. I enjoyed bowl season. I thought even the New Year's Six games, and obviously all of this is getting changed next year anyway, but like Missouri beating Ohio State was fascinating and meaningful on both sides to those of us who love college football. A game like that meant something because Ohio State didn't have anything. And was it a classic best on best? No, it's just different. I don't get it. I get there's this whole bit where you just got to be like, get off my lawn, and it was not as good as the old days, but I liked it.
Yeah, well, specific to the Orange Bowl, it is that we have a fix coming next year. It's called the 12-team playoff.
Mm-hmm.
That game was the single best endorsement of the 12-team playoff you could possibly have, because A, Georgia would be in, and B, Florida State would be in, and their players would presumably play. And so you would actually have two quality teams in the field, competitive, whether, you know, they wouldn't play each other right away. But, you know, you're just going to have fewer teams that are going to mail in the bowl game when you have 12 teams in the playoffs. So it's going to fix itself. That's why if we'd had 12 teams this year, it would have been fixed, and we could have and should have. But so no, I'm not sitting here, you know, hand-wringing over that very much, because help is on the way.
Well, I mean, the I say easy fix, it's not really easy, because it involves skirting NCAA rules, but is building into contracts, NIL contracts or whatnot, that you got to play in the bowl game, and here's your money to do it. Whether that comes from the school, NIL collective, whatever, or maybe the bowl itself, which right now, again, is illegal, kind of. But Nick Cupparelli last year from bowl season, like last December, mentioned to me that that was something that he thinks the NCAA should reconsider the rule around bowls not being able, because right now it's against NCAA rule for bowls to provide NIL to athletes to endorse the game, you know, or endorse any event in general. Postseason basketball or preseason kind of pre-conference basketball tournaments are also included in that. So there are other ways to do it, but it's certainly a conversation piece where you incentivize players to maybe play.
I don't know there's enough money to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're preparing for the NFL...
Both people have said it's not really worth them probably doing. Like it doesn't change viewership to the point where they need to do that. You know,
the ratings are good, the games are good. Just let football be played. They never trust football; they always trust legislation. I don't know. I just don't see it. I'm not. Yeah, there's some clunkers, and yeah, that was ridiculous. But like you said, that gets solved. Playoff, are there some games that aren't going to be good? Just hating on, you know, the Cheez-It bowls or the Pop-Tart bowls, they're finding ways. If two teams want to play football, I saw a lot of enthusiasm in bowl season. I think there's a disconnect between the people who are talking about college football and the people complaining about the bowls and the people that really watch college football.
Yeah, well, and there are tiers here, right? Like, well, first of all, you have the tier of the expanded playoff. You have that group of bowls where you shouldn't have many, if not, you know, any opt-outs at all. But then you have, like, the next tier is the real worry, right? It's those schools that barely miss the expanded playoff. And it's going to be bowls like the Gator Bowl, the Holiday Bowl, the Music City Bowl. And so those bowls are going to kind of turn into what we saw the Orange Bowl, where it's just like, this is an opportunity for a lot of backups to get time, show themselves, prove themselves. And it's kind of exhibition in nature. But then below those bowls is like another tier where you shouldn't have a whole lot of opt-outs. You've kind of got a lot of the group of five and bottom type power five, some that might be making a first bowl and years, you know, and people want to play in it. So you're talking about four to six, maybe six to eight at most, group of bowls there that come right after the playoff expansion. We just all have to kind of realize that bowls are kind of what they always have been, outside of the top two or three bowls that decided the national championship back in the day. They're kind of exhibitions to have practice, more practice days for coaches and players to prepare for next season.
Yeah, go have fun. Speaking of fun, ESPN tonight had a Bourbon Street B-roll.
Ah, yeah.
They had a camera walking down Bourbon Street, broadcast out live to 20-something million or whatever we're watching. And as is the want, as happens on Bourbon Street, there was a flashing.
A stray nipple, Dan.
A nipple was seen on a...
Or as Elaine would say, a nipple, a nip.
A nip slip. It was not a slip. It was purposeful. Yeah. Will America survive, Pat Forty?
No, as a matter of fact, we're shutting down. We are shutting down because there was a nip slip on Bourbon Street. I mean, look, you take a camera down Bourbon Street, you take your chances, right?
Yeah. Lucky that was all it was.
Yeah, right?
You only got one
worse.
Nipple, not two.
I have seen on Bourbon Street.
I think it was,
It was just a one. But there was a child in a stroller next to the nip slip. That's
Louisiana.
The funniest part. If you watch this thing.
Also and very had, Bourbon Street.
For the purposes of podcast host, I had to watch this many times. That was the only reason I watched this.
Oh, please.
Of course. There is a child in a stroller right next to the exposed. Go ahead, Pat.
No. I have seen much more graphic things on Bourbon Street.
Time to track her down and get some comments on having... your nip, like Elaine, shown to all of your friends and family.
20 million people.
Yeah, right.
There's like a legendary story of a TCU fan who was jumping up and down at a game at the AT&T Stadium right as the camera. We don't know whether this is true because nobody has footage of it. But they've told this story, and she's jumping up and down in excitement, and her top kind of slips, and right as the AT&T scoreboard, which is 80 yards long.
It's the biggest scoreboard on earth, the video board.
Broadcaster. It is a half second thing. Nobody apparently have video, but it would be the largest nip slip of all times. Kind of a great honor to have. Maybe, I don't know if you want video proof or not.
Sure.
All right, let's get to this because we're at 4:39 and the reason is because the sunset.
Yes.
I'm serious about this. This is insulting to the fans. There were a lot of people that were not able to watch the end of the Washington-Texas game because the game kicked off after 9 o'clock. It ended at, what, almost 1 Eastern time?
It ended at, 12:50.
I have no idea what time it ended.
12:50 Eastern time. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah.
12:50. People have to work. It's the first day of work, January 2nd. Your boss is all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed down there, ready for a TPC report to get filed, right? Yep. And college football is playing games in the middle of the night. Why? Because the arrogance of the Rose Bowl. We make fun of this sunset, but this is why. Like, it screwed people.
Yes.
Like, they have to have the sun set at the end of the third quarter. The sun is going to set at the time it's going to set. They could move it up and have it set at the end of the first quarter. It's still a beautiful sunset. The sun is not going anywhere, hopefully. The San Gabriel Mountains are not going anywhere.
We got a lot of problems if the sun, you know, is going somewhere.
Bring back the sun.
Yeah, the podcast is going somewhere, too.
If the sun doesn't rise today.
Yeah.
Move the thing up. But the Rose Bowl won't do it because they want to start at 5:10 Eastern. And the arrogance of the Rose Bowl and the arrogance of the commissioners and these ADs and the college football playoff people and everyone else in this sport that won't stand up to the Rose Bowl and say, sorry, buddy, we're kicking it at 3 or you ain't in. Mm-hmm. Because we have all of these fans, millions and millions of fans that want to watch. We spend our year with this sport. We spend our money with this sport. We give it the attention, the whole thing. A lot of people are making millions and millions of dollars off all these fans. And you sit there and say, yeah, you kind of can't. We're going to set it up to make it almost impossible for you to watch the set, one of the semifinal games. Yes, they could do it, but it's not, it shouldn't have to be that choice. Conference championship Sunday in the National Football League, AFC, NFC championship. The first game kicks at 3. The second game kicks at 6:30. Obviously, if there's a triple overtime or whatever you got to do, you move it back a little bit. 5:10 is ridiculous, and it is a testament to the lack of leadership, the lack of courage, the lack of everything in this sport that a lot of people listen to this podcast and get to watch an unbelievable football game in their favorite sport because they had to work. Soapbox.
Close. No, you know what? Well said, and I echo everything that you have said, and that's what this is. Here's the thing. We've talked about this plenty of times, but college fans, college football fans' willingness to put up with being treated like crap bites them in the ass. You know what? And I mean, I don't blame the fans, but they have been played for suckers for decades. We're going to kick off at 11 on a 100-degree day in September because TV says so. We're going to kick off at 9:30 at night on a Thursday or a Monday or whatever because TV says so. We're not going to announce kickoff times until 6 days ahead of time, and it doesn't matter if your plans to travel to a game work around that or not because TV says so. And that's just the way the fans get used and abused, but they put up with it. And so it's just going to keep happening this way. But it is a complete miscarriage, really, to have games, big games, games people care about immensely, ending at 1 a.m.
Yeah, it's kind of time for college football to break out of this like long-standing acquiescing to TV in you know, this like amateur type of we're the little guy and we just have to kind of be bossed around, pushed around a little bit. Like college football in the last, I think, 3 years has proven TV viewership wise is the number two sport in the country. And it's kind of time to start acting like it. And that means kind of putting the foot down with stuff like this. You know, in another option to this today, honestly, would have been to kick off the Sugar Bowl at 1:30 p.m. If they weren't going to move it. Yeah, I mean, it's New Year's Day. People are on the couch watching TV. Like, have the Citrus Bowl at night or something, but like put the playoffs in, you know, where people can watch them.
I mean, it's unbelievable. You want young people to watch. I mean, kids got to go back to school. They got this, you got that. Like, and I know, you know, why. I mean, it's not as big of a deal on the West Coast, but there's a lot of people. Biggest time zone is the Eastern time zone. And yeah. I feel bad. People watch the whole year, and this is one of the three most important games of the year. And they make it impossible. And their reason, when you ask them, is, well, we can't tell the Rose Bowl what to do.
Yeah.
What in the living, what? The guys can't even imagine any other business run this way. And you, us three and Sean, this is our jobs. We can stay up till 4:45 and do a podcast.
Yeah.
We don't have to punch a clock tomorrow at 8 a.m. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So no, it's not that big of a deal for us, but.
Right.
But that doesn't flight.
I got a flight at 7:30. But okay. If you're a school bus driver and you got to be on the route at 7 a.m. tomorrow, you can't stay up and watch this stuff. I mean, it is a ridiculous hardship that they put on fans because they can.
It's a joke. The sunset's a funny joke, but they next time this comes up, they need to put those semifinals 3:00, 6:45. College game's a little bit longer. That's it. That's your semifinals on New Year's Day. Enough with this middle of the night stuff. If it's New Year's Eve, maybe it's a little different. But for New Year's Day, this is embarrassing. It's embarrassing, and no one's got a good answer for it.
Well, and with this expanded playoff, we're gonna have all kind of crazy times.
Right.
Brace yourselves because they're gonna be scheduling around the NFL. There's going to be probably a Thursday night first round game. You know, I mean, this is probably not going to get any better anytime soon.
All I ask is they care about the fans a little bit. Think about the fans. All right. Finally, quick look ahead. 1 week, Washington Michigan. I think Michigan is opened as a 4.5-point favorite. Obviously, the Dylan Johnson news will be very interesting, and any other injuries that come out of there. Clash of styles. Quick thoughts, Pat.
I picked Washington over Michigan to win the championship back when the Selection Sunday came out, so I'm sticking with that. I will keep riding with the Huskies. It's going to be tough, though, because, yes, if Dylan Johnson's out, the running game is compromised, and I do think Michigan can really cover. But you can be able to really cover, and those receivers are going to still make plays downfield. I mean, Jeff Schwartz, who does a fair amount of commentary, said that 50-50 balls for Washington receivers are more like 95-5 balls because they just win those battles so routinely. So I'm riding with the – yeah. Riding with the best quarterback and the best receivers, and see if they can light it up again through the air against the Wolverines.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this matchup in completely drastically different styles of football. We talked a lot about the lines and the building of the lines of Michigan, and just like the running game and the short passing game and all that stuff, high percentage throws and all that. And then Washington, it's like kind of the opposite. It's just like, we're deep heaving this thing. And we're going to go for it. Right. And, I love the contrasting styles of this thing. And there's some other kind of like off the field type of things that are really fascinating. You know, obviously these two schools will be conference mates next year, and I think Washington's hosting Michigan next season.
Yeah,
to open the Big
October
10.
Or something. Yeah,
yeah. So
Michigan's
it's
hosting Texas too.
Yeah,
there yeah. You go. It's gonna be
yeah,
wild.
It's yeah. Wild. Yeah. So it's yeah. I'm pumped to see this one, and
it's gonna be great.
Pumped to see two different styles kind of clash on the field there.
Yeah, it'll be very very interesting. Michigan is so hard to beat. And at the same time, I think the reason I picked Washington to beat Texas, I was like, Michael Penix will figure it out. And he sure did. So I don't know. I won't make a pick now. I'll let this play out a little bit. But it's going to be a good one. So we will have a show later this week previewing all that and talking about everything else. We appreciate everyone listening. Thanks for, our audience is what motivates us to do things in the middle of the night. We want you guys all set up. And special thank you to Sean Anderson, our producer extraordinaire, who's hope we got the coffee on.
Yeah, tough. He's got some hours of work here to do to get this ready for everybody bright and early when they wake up.
Tough one. So, all right, we appreciate you. Continue to subscribe, share us on social media, tell your friends about us. We will talk to you later.